or were unaware of what had taken place, and helpfully led Diels and a contingent of police to Pakebusch's office. The surprise was total. As Diels entered, he saw Pakebusch at his desk in shirt sleeves, the black jacket of his uniform hanging on an adjacent wall, along with his belt and holstered pistol. He sat there, brooding over the papers on his desk, like a scholar working into the night, Diels wrote. Diels was outraged. They were my papers he was working on, and defacing, as I soon discovered, with inept annotations. Diels found that Pakebusch even saw evil in the way Diels and his wife had decorated their apartment. In one note, Pakebusch had scrawled the phrase, "Furnishing style a la Stresemann," a reference to the late Gustav Stresemann, a Weimar-era opponent of Hitler. "You're under arrest," Diels said. Pakebusch looked up abruptly. One instant he had been reading Diels's personal papers, and the next Diels was standing before him. Pakebusch had no time to recover from his surprise, Diels wrote. "He stared at me as if I were an apparition." Diels's men seized Pakebusch. One officer took the SS captain's pistol from his gun belt on the wall, but apparently no one bothered to conduct a more thorough search of Pakebusch himself. Police officers moved through the building to arrest other men whom Diels believed had taken part in the raid on his apartment. All suspects were transported to Gestapo headquarters. Pakebusch was brought to Diels's office. There, in the early hours of morning, Diels and Pakebusch sat facing each other, both livid. Diels's Alsatian wolf dog, in that time the official name for German shepherds, stood nearby, watchful. Diels vowed to put Pakebusch in prison. Pakebusch accused Diels of treason. Infuriated by Pakebusch's insolence, Diels rocketed from his chair in a flare of anger. Pakebusch loosed his own freshet of obscenities and pulled a hidden pistol from a back pocket of his pants. He aimed it at Diels, finger on the trigger. Diels's dog hurtled into the scene, leaping toward Pakebusch, according to Diels's account. Two uniformed officers grabbed Pakebusch and wrenched the gun from his hand. Diels ordered him placed in the Gestapo's house prison in the basement. In short order, Goering and Himmler got involved and struck a compromise. Goering removed Diels as head of the Gestapo and made him assistant police commissioner in Berlin. Diels recognized that the new job was a demotion to a post with no real power, at least not the kind of power he would need to hold his own against Himmler if the SS chief chose to seek further revenge. Nonetheless, he accepted the arrangement, and so things stood until one morning later that month when two loyal employees flagged him down as he drove to work. They told him that agents of the SS were waiting for him in his office with an arrest order. Diels fled. In his memoir, he claims that his wife recommended he bring along a friend, an American woman, who could be helpful when crossing borders. She lived in a flat on Tiergartenstrasse, he wrote, and she liked risk. I knew her enthusiasm for danger and adventure. His clues bring Martha immediately to mind, but she made no mention of such a journey in her memoir or in any of her other writings. Diels and his companion drove to Potsdam, then south to the border, where he left his car in a garage. He carried a false passport. They crossed the border into Czechoslovakia and proceeded to the spa city of Carlsbad, where they checked into a hotel. Diels also took along some of his more sensitive files as insurance. From his retreat in Bohemia, wrote Hans Gisevius, the Gestapo memoirist, he threatened embarrassing revelations and asked a high price for keeping his mouth shut. With Diels gone, many in Martha's growing circle of friends doubtless breathed a little more easily, especially those who harbored sympathy for communists or mourned the lost freedoms of the Weimar past. Her social life continued to blossom. Of all her new friends, the one she found most compelling was Mildred Fisch-Harnack, whom she had first encountered on the train platform upon arriving in Berlin. Mildred spoke flawless German, and by most accounts was a beauty, tall and slender, with long blonde hair that she wore in a thick coil and large, serious blue eyes. She shunned all makeup. Later, after a certain secret of hers was revealed, A description of her would surface in Soviet intelligence files that sketched her as very much the German Frau, an intensely Nordic type, and very useful. She stood out not just because of her looks, Martha saw, but also because of her manner. She was slow to speak and express opinions, Martha wrote. She listened quietly, weighing and evaluating the words, thoughts, and motivations in conversation. Her words were thoughtful, sometimes ambiguous when it was necessary to feel people out. This art of parsing the motives and attitudes of others had become especially important given how she and her husband, Arvid Harnack, had spent the preceding few years. The two had met in 1926 at the University of Wisconsin, where Mildred was an instructor. They married that August, moved to Germany, and eventually settled in Berlin. Along the way, they demonstrated a talent for bringing people together. At each stop, they formed a salon that convened at regular intervals for meals, conversation, lectures, even group readings of Shakespeare's plays, all echoes of a famous group they had joined in Wisconsin, the Friday Nighters, founded by John R. Commons, a professor and leading progressive, who one day would become known as the spiritual father of Social Security. In Berlin, in the winter of 1930-31, Arvid founded yet another group, this devoted to the study of Soviet Russia's planned economy. As the Nazi Party gained sway, his field of interest became decidedly problematic. But he nonetheless arranged and led a tour of the Soviet Union for some 24 German economists and engineers. While abroad, he was recruited by Soviet intelligence to work secretly against the Nazis. He agreed. When Hitler came to power, Arvid felt compelled to disband his planned economy group. The political climate had grown lethal. He and Mildred retreated to the countryside, where Mildred spent her time writing, and Arvid took a job as a lawyer for the German airline Lufthansa. After the initial spasm of anti-communist terror subsided, the Harnacks returned to their apartment in Berlin. Surprisingly, given his background, Arvid got a job within the Ministry of Economics and began a rapid rise that prompted some of Mildred's friends in America to decide that she and Arvid had gone Nazi. Early on, Martha knew nothing of Arvid's covert life. She loved visiting the couple's apartment, which was bright and cozy and pasteled with comforting hues, dove tans, soft blues and greens. Mildred filled large vases with lavender cosmos and placed them in front of a pale yellow wall. Martha and Mildred came to see each other as kindred spirits, both deeply interested in writing. By late September 1933, the two had arranged to write a column on books for an English-language newspaper called Berlin Topics. In a September 25, 1933 letter to Thornton Wilder, Martha described the newspaper as lousy, but said she hoped it might serve as a catalyst to build up a little colony in the English-speaking group here. Get people together who like books and authors. When the Harnacks traveled, Mildred sent Martha postcards upon which she wrote poetic observations of the scenery before her and warm expressions of affection. On one card Mildred wrote, "Martha, you know that I love you and think of you through it all." She thanked Martha for reading and critiquing some of her writing. "It shows a gift in you," she wrote. She closed with an inked sigh. "Oh, my dear, dot, 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 life." The ellipsis was hers. To Martha, these cards were like petals falling from an unseen place. "I prized these postcards and short letters, with their delicate, almost tremblingly sensitive prose. There was nothing studied or affected about them. Their feelings sprang simply from her full and joyous heart, and had to be expressed." Mildred became a regular guest at embassy functions, and by November she was earning extra pay typing the manuscript of the first volume of Dodd's Old South. Martha, in turn, became a regular attendee at a new salon that Mildred and Arvid established, the Berlin equivalent of the Friday Nighters. Ever the organizers, they accumulated a society of loyal friends, writers, editors, artists, intellectuals, who convened at their apartment several times a month for weekday suppers and Saturday afternoon teas. Here, Martha noted in a letter to Wilder, she met the writer Ernst von Solomon, notorious for having played a role in the 1922 assassination of Weimar Foreign Minister Walter Rathenau. She loved the cozy atmosphere Mildred conjured, despite having little money to spare. There were lamps, candles, and flowers, and a tray of thin bread, cheese, liverwurst, and sliced tomatoes. Not a banquet, but enough. Her host, Martha told Wilder, was the kind of person who has the sense or nonsense to put a candle behind a bunch of pussy willows or alpenrosen. The talk was bright, smart, and daring. Too daring at times, at least in the view of Solomon's wife, whose perspective was shaped partly by the fact she was Jewish. She was appalled at how casually the guests would call Himmler and Hitler utter fools in her presence, without knowing who she was or where her sympathies lay. She watched one guest pass a yellow envelope to another and then wink like an uncle slipping a piece of forbidden candy to a nephew. "And there I sit on the sofa," she said, "and can hardly breathe." Martha found it thrilling and gratifying, despite the group's anti-Nazi bent. She staunchly defended the Nazi Revolution as offering the best way out of the chaos that had engulfed Germany ever since the past war. Her participation in the Salon reinforced her sense of herself as a writer and intellectual. In addition to attending the correspondence Stammtisch at Die Taverne, she began spending a lot of time in the great old Berlin cafes, those still not fully coordinated, such as the Josti on Potsdamer Platz and the Romanisches on the Kurfürstendamm. The latter, which could seat up to 1,000 people, had a storied past as a haven for the likes of Erich Maria Remarque, Joseph Roth, and Billy Wilder, though all by now had been driven from Berlin. She went out to dinner often and to nightclubs like Ciro's and the Eden Roof. Ambassador Dodd's papers are silent on the matter, but given his frugality, he must have found Martha to be an unexpectedly and alarmingly costly presence on the family ledger. Martha hoped to stake a place in Berlin's cultural landscape all her own, not just by dint of her friendship with the Harnacks, and she wanted that place to be a prominent one. She brought Solomon to one staid U.S. embassy function, clearly hoping to cause a stir. She succeeded. In a letter to Wilder, she exulted in the crowd's reaction as Solomon appeared. The astonishment. There was a little hushed gasping and whispering behind hands from the oh-so-proper gathering. Ernst von Solomon, accomplice in the Rathenau murder. She coveted attention and got it. Solomon described the guests gathered at one U.S. embassy party, possibly the same one, as the capital's jeunesse dorée, smart young men with perfect manners, smiling attractively or laughing gaily at Martha Dodd's witty sallies. She grew bolder. The time had come, she knew, to start throwing some parties of her own. Meanwhile, Diels, still abroad and living well at a swank hotel in Carlsbad, began putting out feelers to gauge the mood back in Berlin, whether it was safe yet for him to return. For that matter, whether it would ever be safe. Chapter 18. Warning from a Friend. Martha grew increasingly confident about her social appeal, enough so that she organized her own afternoon salon, modeled on the teas and evening discussion groups of her friend Mildred Fish Harnack. She also threw herself a birthday party. Both events unfolded in ways markedly different from what she had hoped for. In selecting guests for her salon, she used her own contacts as well as Mildred's. She invited several dozen poets, writers, and editors for the ostensible purpose of meeting a visiting American publisher. Martha hoped to hear amusing conversation, some exchange of stimulating views, at least conversation on a higher plane than one is accustomed to in diplomatic society. But the guests brought an unexpected companion. Instead of forming a lively and vibrant company with her at its center, the crowd became atomized, small groups here and there. A poet sat in the library with several guests clustered near. Others gathered tightly around the guest of honor, exhibiting what Martha termed a pathetic eagerness to know what was happening in America. Her Jewish guests looked especially ill at ease. The talk lagged. The consumption of food and alcohol surged. The rest of the guests were standing around drinking heavily and devouring plates of food, Martha wrote. Probably many of them were poor and actually ill-fed, and the others were nervous and anxious to conceal it. In all, Martha wrote, it was a dull and at the same time tense afternoon. The uninvited guest was fear, and it haunted the gathering. The crowd, she wrote, was so full of frustration and misery, of tension, broken spirits, doomed courage, or tragic and hated cowardice, that I vowed never to have such a group again in my house. Instead, she resigned herself to helping the Harnacks with their regular soirees and teas. They did have a gift for gathering loyal and compelling friends and holding them close. The idea that one day it would kill them would have seemed at the time to Martha utterly laughable. The guest list for her birthday party set for October 8th, her actual birth date, included a princess, a prince, several of her correspondent friends, and various officers of the SA and SS, young, heel-clicking, courteous almost to the point of absurdity. Whether Boris Vinogradov attended is unclear, though by now Martha was seeing him regularly. It's possible, even likely, that she didn't invite him, for the United States still had not recognized the Soviet Union. Two prominent Nazi officials made appearances at the party. One was Putzi Hanfstengel, the other Hans Thomsen, a young man who served as liaison between the Foreign Ministry and Hitler's Chancellery. He had never exhibited the overheated swoon so evident in other Nazi zealots, and as a consequence he was well-liked by members of the diplomatic corps and a frequent visitor to the Dodds' home. Martha's father often spoke with him in terms more blunt than diplomatic protocol allowed, confident that Thomsen would relay his views to senior Nazi officials, possibly even to Hitler himself. At times, Martha had the impression that Thomsen might harbor personal reservations about Hitler. She and Dodd called him Tommy. Hanfstengel arrived late, as was his custom. He craved attention, and by dint of his immense height and energy always got it, no matter how crowded the room. He had become immersed in conversation with a musically knowledgeable guest about the merits of Schubert's unfinished symphony, when Martha walked to the family's Victrola and put on a recording of the Nazi hymn to Horst Wessel, the anthem she had heard sung in Nuremberg by the parading stormtroopers. Hanfstengel seemed to enjoy the music. Hans Thomsen clearly did not. He stood abruptly, then marched to the record player and switched it off. In her most innocent manner, Martha asked him why he didn't like the music. Thomsen glared, his face hard. That is not the sort of music to be played for mixed gatherings, and in a flippant manner, he scolded. I won't have you play our anthem with its significance at a social party. Martha was stunned. This was her house, her party, and moreover, American ground. She could do as she pleased. Hanfstengel looked at Thomsen with what Martha described as a vivid look of amusement tinged with contempt. He shrugged his shoulders, then sat down at the piano and began hammering away with his usual boisterous elan. Later Hanfstengel took Martha aside. Yes, he said, there are some people like that among us, people who have blind spots and are humorless. One must be careful not to offend their sensitive souls. For Martha, however, Thomson's display had a lingering effect of surprising power, for it eroded, albeit slightly, her enthusiasm for the new Germany, in the way a single ugly phrase can tilt a marriage toward decline. Accustomed all my life to the free exchange of views, she wrote, The atmosphere of this evening shocked me, and struck me as a sort of violation of the decencies of human relationship. Dodd, too, was fast gaining an appreciation of the prickly sensitivities of the day. No event provided a better measure of these than a speech he gave before the Berlin branch of the American Chamber of Commerce on Columbus Day, October 12, 1933. His talk managed to stir a furor not only in Germany, but also, as Dodd was dismayed to learn, within the State Department and among many Americans who favored keeping the nation from entangling itself in European affairs. Dodd believed that an important part of his mission was to exert quiet pressure toward moderation, or, as he wrote in a letter to the Chicago lawyer Leo Wormser, to continue to persuade and entreat men here not to be their own worst enemies. The invitation to speak seemed to present an ideal opportunity. His plan was to use history to telegraph criticism of the Nazi regime, but obliquely, so that only those in the audience with a good grasp of ancient and modern history would understand the underlying message. In America, a speech of this nature would have seemed anything but heroic. Amid the mounting oppression of Nazi rule, it was positively daring. Dodd explained his motivation in a letter to Jane Addams. "It was because I had seen so much of injustice and domineering little groups, as well as heard the complaints of so many of the best people of the country, that I ventured as far as my position would allow, and by historical analogy warned men as solemnly as possible against half-educated leaders being permitted to lead nations into war." He gave the talk the innocuous title, Economic Nationalism. By citing the rise and fall of Caesar and episodes from French, English, and U.S. history, Dodd sought to warn of the dangers of arbitrary and minority government without ever actually mentioning contemporary Germany. It was not the kind of thing a traditional diplomat might have undertaken, but Dodd saw it as simply fulfilling Roosevelt's original mandate. In defending himself later, Dodd wrote, "The president told me pointedly that he wanted me to be a standing representative and spokesman on occasion of American ideals and philosophy." He spoke in a banquet room at the Adlon Hotel before a large audience that included a number of senior government officials, including Reichsbank President Hjalmar Schacht, and two men from Goebbels' Ministry of Propaganda. Dodd knew he was about to step upon very sensitive terrain. He understood as well, given the many foreign correspondents in the room, that the talk would get wide press coverage in Germany, America, and Britain. As he began to read, he sensed a quiet excitement permeate the hall. "In times of great stress," he began, "men are too apt to abandon too much of their past social devices and venture too far upon uncharted courses. And the consequence has always been reaction, sometimes disaster." He stepped into the deep past to begin his elusive journey with the examples of Tiberius Gracchus, a populist leader, and Julius Caesar. Half-educated statesmen today swing violently away from the ideal purpose of the first Gracchus and think they find salvation for their troubled fellows in the arbitrary modes of the man who fell an easy victim to the cheap devices of the lewd Cleopatra. "They forget," he said, "that the Caesars succeeded only for a short moment as measured by the test of history." He described similar moments in English and French history, and here offered the example of Jean-Baptiste Colbert, the powerful minister of finance under Louis XIV. In an apparent allusion to the relationship between Hitler and Hindenburg, he told his audience how Colbert was granted despotic powers. He dispossessed hundreds of great families of newly rich folk, handed their properties over to the crown, condemned thousands to death because they resisted him. The recalcitrant landed aristocracy was everywhere subdued. Parliaments were not allowed to assemble. Autocratic rule persisted in France until 1789, the start of the French Revolution, when with a crash and a thunder it collapsed. Governments from the top fail as often as those from the bottom, and every great failure brings a sad social reaction, thousands and millions of helpless men laying down their lives in the unhappy process. Why may not statesmen study the past and avoid such catastrophes? After a few more allusions, he came to his ending. In conclusion, he said, one may safely say that it would be no sin if statesmen learned enough of history to realize that no system which implies control of society by privilege seekers has ever ended in any other way than collapse. To fail to learn from such blunders of the past, he said, was to end up on a course toward another war and chaos. The applause, Dodd said in his diary, was extraordinary. In describing the moment to Roosevelt, Dodd noted that even Schacht applauded extravagantly, as did all other Germans present. I have never noted more unanimous approval. He wrote to Secretary Hull, when the thing was over, about every German present showed and expressed a kind of approval which revealed the thought, you have said what all of us have been denied the right to say. An official of the Deutsche Bank called to express his own agreement. He told Dodd, silent but anxious Germany, above all the business and university Germany, is entirely with you, and most thankful that you are here and can say what we cannot say. That these listeners understood the true intent of Dodd's speech was obvious. Afterward, Bella Fromm, the society columnist for the Vossische Zeitung, who was fast becoming a friend of the Dodd family, told him, I enjoyed all these nicely disguised hints against Hitler and Hitlerism. Dodd gave her an arch grin. I had no delusions about Hitler when I was appointed to my post in Berlin, he answered, but I had at least hoped to find some decent people around Hitler. I am horrified to discover that the whole gang is nothing but a horde of criminals and cowards. Fromm later chided the French ambassador to Germany, André-François Poncet, for missing the speech. His response encapsulated a fundamental quandary of traditional diplomacy. The situation is very difficult, he said, with a smile. One is at once a diplomat and must hide one's feelings. One must please one's superiors at home and yet not be expelled from here. But I, too, am glad that His Excellency Mr. Dodd cannot be subverted by flattery and high honor. Dodd was heartened by the response from his audience. He told Roosevelt, my interpretation of this is that all liberal Germany is with us, and more than half of Germany is at heart liberal. The response elsewhere was decidedly less positive, as Dodd quickly found. Goebbels blocked publication of the speech, although three large newspapers published excerpts anyway. The next day, Friday, Dodd arrived at Foreign Minister Neurath's office for a previously scheduled meeting, only to be told Neurath could not see him, a clear breach of diplomatic custom. In a cable to Washington that afternoon, Dodd told Secretary Hull that Neurath's action seemed to constitute a serious affront to our government. Dodd finally got to see Neurath at 8 o'clock that night. Neurath claimed to have been too busy to see him during the day, but Dodd knew that the minister had been free enough from pressing obligations to have lunch with a minor diplomat. Dodd wrote in his diary that he suspected Hitler himself might have forced the postponement as a sort of rebuke for my speech of yesterday. To his greater surprise, he also sensed a groundswell of criticism from America, and took steps to defend himself. He promptly sent Roosevelt a verbatim copy, and told the president he was doing so because he feared that some embarrassing interpretations may have been put out at home. That same day, he also sent a copy to Undersecretary Phillips, in the hope that you, acquainted with all the precedents, may explain to Secretary Hull, i.e., if he or anybody else in the department seems to think I have done our cause here any harm. If he expected Phillips to rise to his defense, he was mistaken. Phillips and other senior men in the State Department, including Moffat, the Western European Affairs chief, were becoming increasingly unhappy with the ambassador. These ranking members of Hugh Wilson's pretty good club seized upon Dodd's speech as further evidence that he was the wrong man for the post. Moffat, in his diary, likened Dodd's performance to the schoolmaster lecturing his pupils. Phillips, master of the art of palace whisper, took delight in Dodd's discomfort. He ignored several of Dodd's letters, in which the ambassador sought official advice on whether to accept future public speaking offers. At last, Phillips did reply with apologies, explaining that I was in doubt whether any words from me could be of help or guidance to you who are living in a world so wholly different from that in which most ambassadors find themselves. Though he congratulated Dodd on the high art he exhibited in crafting a speech that let him speak his mind, yet avoid giving direct offense, Phillips also offered a quiet rebuke. In brief, my feeling is that an ambassador, who is a privileged guest of the country to which he is accredited, should be careful not to give public expression to anything in the nature of criticism of his adopted country, because in so doing he loses ipso facto the confidence of those very public officials whose goodwill is so important to him in the success of his mission. Dodd still seemed unaware of it, but several members of the Pretty Good Club had been stepping up their campaign against him with the ultimate aim of ousting him from their ranks. In October, his longtime friend Colonel House sent him a quiet side-saddle warning. First came the good news. House had just met with Roosevelt. It was delightful to hear the President say that he was pleased beyond measure with the work you are doing in Berlin. But then House had visited the State Department. In the strictest confidence, they did not speak of you with the same enthusiasm as the President, he wrote. I insisted on something concrete, and all that I could get was that you did not keep them well informed. I am telling you this so you may be guided in the future. On Saturday, October 14th, 2 days after his Columbus Day address, Dodd was in the middle of a dinner party he was hosting for military and naval attachés when he received startling news. Hitler had just announced his decision to withdraw Germany from the League of Nations and from a major disarmament conference that had been underway in Geneva off and on since February 1932. Dodd found a radio and immediately heard the coarse voice of the Chancellor, though he was struck by the absence of Hitler's usual histrionics. Dodd listened intently as Hitler portrayed Germany as a well-meaning, peace-seeking nation, whose modest desire for equality of armaments was being opposed by other nations. It was not the address of a thinker, Dodd wrote in his diary, but of an emotionalist claiming that Germany had in no way been responsible for the World War and that she was the victim of wicked enemies. It was a stunning development. In one stroke, Dodd realized, Hitler had emasculated the League and virtually nullified the Treaty of Versailles, clearly declaring his intention to rearm Germany. He announced as well that he was dissolving the Reichstag and would hold new elections on November 12th. The ballot also would invite the public to pass judgment on his foreign policy through a yes-or-no plebiscite. Secretly, Hitler also gave orders to General Werner von Blomberg, his Minister of Defense, to prepare for possible military action by League members seeking to enforce the Treaty of Versailles, although Blomberg knew full well that Germany's small army could not hope to prevail against a combined action by France, Poland, and Czechoslovakia. That the Allies at this time could easily have overwhelmed Germany is as certain as it is that such an action would have brought the end of the Third Reich in the very year of its birth, wrote William Shirer in his classic work, The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich. But Hitler knew the mettle of his foreign adversaries as expertly and as uncannily as he had sized up that of his opponents at home. Though Dodd continued to nurture the hope that the German government would grow more civil, he recognized that Hitler's two decisions signaled an ominous shift away from moderation. The time had come, he knew, to meet with Hitler face to face. Dodd went to bed that night deeply troubled. Shortly before noon, on Tuesday, October 17, 1933, Roosevelt's standing liberal set out in top hat and tails for his first meeting with Adolf Hitler. Chapter 19. Matchmaker. Fritzi Hanfstengel knew of Martha's various romantic relationships, but by the fall of 1933 he had begun to imagine for her a new partner. Having come to feel that Hitler would be a much more reasonable leader if only he fell in love, Hanfstengel appointed himself matchmaker. He knew this would not be easy. As one of Hitler's closest associates, he recognized that the history of Hitler's relationships with women was an odd one, marred by tragedy and persistent rumors of unsavory behavior. Hitler liked women, but more as stage decoration than as sources of intimacy and love. There had been talk of numerous liaisons, typically with women much younger than he, in one case a 16-year-old named Maria Reiter. One woman, Eva Braun, was 23 years his junior and had been an intermittent companion since 1929. So far, however, Hitler's only all-consuming affair had been with his young niece, Jelly Raubel. She was found shot to death in Hitler's apartment, his revolver nearby. The most likely explanation was suicide, her means of escaping Hitler's jealous and oppressive affection, his clammy possessiveness, as historian Ian Kershaw put it. Hanfstengel suspected that Hitler once had been attracted to his own wife, Helena, but she assured him there was no cause for jealousy. "Believe me," she said, "he's an absolute neuter, not a man." Hanfstengel telephoned Martha at home. "Hitler needs a woman," he said. "Hitler should have an American woman. A lovely woman could change the whole destiny of Europe." He got to the point. "Martha," he said, "you are the woman." Part 4. How the Skeleton Aches. Chapter 20. The Führer's Kiss. Dodd walked up a broad stairway toward Hitler's office, at each bend encountering SS men with their arms raised, Caesar style, as Dodd put it. He bowed in response, and at last entered Hitler's waiting room. After a few moments, the black tall door to Hitler's office opened. Foreign Minister Neurath stepped out to welcome Dodd and to bring him to Hitler. The office was an immense room, by Dodd's estimate 50 feet by 50 feet, with ornately decorated walls and ceiling. Hitler, neat and erect, wore an ordinary business suit. Dodd noted that he looked better than newspaper photographs indicated. Even so, Hitler did not cut a particularly striking figure. He rarely did. Early in his rise, it was easy for those who met him for the first time to dismiss him as a nonentity. He came from plebeian roots, and had failed to distinguish himself in any way, not in war, not in work, not in art, though in this last domain he believed himself to have great talent. He was said to be indolent. He rose late, worked little, and surrounded himself with the lesser lights of the party with whom he felt most comfortable, an entourage of middle-brow souls that Putzi Hanfstengel derisively nicknamed the Chauffeureska, consisting of bodyguards, adjutants, and a chauffeur. He loved movies. King Kong was a favorite, and he adored the music of Richard Wagner. He dressed badly. Apart from his mustache and his eyes, the features of his face were indistinct and unimpressive, as if begun in clay but never fired. Recalling his first impression of Hitler, Hanfstengel wrote, "Hitler looked like a suburban hairdresser on his day off." Nonetheless, the man had a remarkable ability to transform himself into something far more compelling, especially when speaking in public or during private meetings when some topic enraged him. He had a knack as well for projecting an aura of sincerity that blinded onlookers to his true motives and beliefs. Though Dodd had not yet come to a full appreciation of this aspect of his character. First, Dodd raised the subject of the many attacks against Americans. Hitler was cordial and apologetic, and assured Dodd that the perpetrators of all such attacks would be punished to the limit. He promised as well to publicize widely his prior decrees exempting foreigners from giving the Hitler salute. After some bland conversation about Germany's debts to American creditors, Dodd moved to the topic most on his mind, the all-pervasive question of the German thunderbolt of last Saturday, Hitler's decision to withdraw from the League of Nations. When Dodd asked him why he had pulled Germany from the League, Hitler grew visibly angry. He attacked the Treaty of Versailles and France's drive to maintain superiority in arms over Germany. He railed against the indignity of keeping Germany in an unequal state, unable to defend herself against her neighbors. Hitler's sudden rage startled Dodd. He tried to appear unfazed, less a diplomat now than a professor dealing with an overwrought student. He told Hitler, "There is evident injustice in the French attitude, but defeat in war is always followed by injustice." He raised the example of the aftermath of the American Civil War and the North's terrible treatment of the South. Hitler stared at him. After a brief period of silence, the conversation resumed, and for a few moments the two men engaged in what Dodd described as an exchange of niceties. But now Dodd asked whether an incident on the Polish, Austrian, or French border, which drew an enemy into the Reich, would be enough for Hitler to launch a war. "No, no," Hitler insisted. Dodd probed further. "Suppose," he asked, "such an incident were to involve the Ruhr Valley, an industrial region about which Germans were particularly sensitive. France had occupied the Ruhr from 1923 to 1925, causing great economic and political turmoil within Germany. In the event of another such incursion," Dodd asked, "would Germany respond militarily on its own, or call for an international meeting to resolve the matter?" "That would be my purpose," Hitler said. "But we might not be able to restrain the German people." Dodd said, "If he would wait and call a conference, Germany would regain her popularity outside." Soon the meeting came to an end. It had lasted 45 minutes. Though the session had been difficult and strange, Dodd nonetheless left the Chancellery feeling convinced that Hitler was sincere about wanting peace. He was concerned, however, that he might again have violated the laws of diplomacy. "Perhaps I was too frank," he wrote later to Roosevelt, "but I had to be honest." At 6 p.m. that day, he sent a 2-page cable to Secretary Hull, summarizing the meeting, and closed by telling Hull, "The total effect of the interview was more favorable from the point of view of the maintenance of world peace than I had expected." Dodd also conveyed these impressions to Consul General Messersmith, who then sent Under Secretary Phillips a letter, at 18 pages, a characteristically long one, in which he seemed intent on undermining Dodd's credibility. He challenged the ambassador's appraisal of Hitler. "The Chancellor's assurances were so satisfying and so unexpected that I think they are on the whole too good to be true," Messersmith wrote. "We must keep in mind, I believe, that when Hitler says anything, he for the moment convinces himself that it is true. He is basically sincere, but he is at the same time a fanatic." Messersmith urged skepticism regarding Hitler's protestations. "I think for the moment he genuinely desires peace, but it is a peace of his own kind, and with an armed force constantly becoming more effective in reserve, in order to impose their will when it may become essential." He reiterated his belief that Hitler's government could not be viewed as a rational entity. "There are so many pathological cases involved that it would be impossible to tell from day to day what will happen, any more than the keeper of a madhouse is able to tell what his inmates will do in the next hour or during the next day." He urged caution, in effect warning Phillips to be skeptical of Dodd's conviction that Hitler wanted peace. "I think for the present moment we must guard against any undue optimism which may be aroused by the apparently satisfying declarations of the Chancellor." On the morning of the rendezvous that Putzi Hemfstengel had arranged for Martha with Hitler, she dressed carefully, seeing as she had been appointed to change the history of Europe. To her it seemed a lark of the first order. She was curious to meet this man she once had dismissed as a clown, but whom she now was convinced was a glamorous and brilliant personality who must have great power and charm. She decided to wear her most demure and intriguing best, nothing too striking or revealing, for the Nazi ideal was a woman who wore little makeup, tended her man, and bore as many children as possible. German men, she wrote, want their women to be seen and not heard, and then seen only as appendages of the splendid male they accompany. She considered wearing a veil. Hemfstengel picked her up in his huge car and drove to the Kaiserhof, 7 blocks away on Wilhelmplatz, just off the southeast corner of the Tiergarten. A grand hotel with a cavernous lobby and an arched entrance portico, the Kaiserhof had been Hitler's home until his ascension to chancellor. Now Hitler often had lunch or tea in the hotel, surrounded by his chaufferesca. Hemfstengel had arranged that he and Martha would be joined for lunch by another party, a Polish tenor, Jan Kipura, 31 years old. Hemfstengel, well known and unmistakable, was treated with deference by the restaurant staff. Once seated, Martha and the two men chatted over tea and waited. In time, a commotion arose at the entrance to the dining room, and soon came the inevitable rumble of chairs shoved back and shouts of Heil Hitler. Hitler and his party, including indeed his chauffeur, took seats at an adjacent table. First, Kipura was ushered to Hitler's side. The two spoke about music. Hitler seemed unaware that Kipura under Nazi law was classified as Jewish by maternal heritage. A few moments later, Hemfstengel came over and bent low to Hitler's ear. He barreled back to Martha with the news that Hitler would now see her. She walked to Hitler's table and stood there a moment as Hitler rose to greet her. He took her hand and kissed it, and spoke a few quiet words in German. She got a close look at him now, a weak, soft face with pouches under the eyes, full lips, and very little bony facial structure. At this vantage, she wrote, the mustache didn't seem as ridiculous as it appeared in pictures. In fact, I scarcely noticed it. What she did notice were his eyes. She had heard elsewhere that there was something piercing and intense about his gaze, and now immediately she understood. Hitler's eyes, she wrote, were startling and unforgettable. They seemed pale blue in color, were intense, unwavering, hypnotic. Yet his manner was gentle, excessively gentle, she wrote, more that of a shy teenager than an iron dictator. Unobtrusive, communicative, informal, he had a certain quiet charm, almost a tenderness of speech and glance, she wrote. Hitler now turned back to the tenor, and with what seemed to be real interest, rekindled their conversation about music. He seemed modest, middle class, rather dull and self-conscious, yet with this strange tenderness and appealing helplessness, Martha wrote. It was hard to believe that this man was one of the most powerful men in Europe. Martha and Hitler shook hands once again, and for the second time he kissed hers. She returned to her table and to Hemfstengel. They remained a while longer over tea, eavesdropping on the continuing conversation between Kipura and Hitler. Now and then Hitler would look her way, with what she judged to be curious, embarrassed stares. That night, over dinner, she told her parents all about the day's encounter and how charming and peaceful the Führer had been. Dodd was amused and conceded that Hitler was not an unattractive man personally. He teased Martha and told her to be sure to take note of exactly where Hitler's lips had touched her hand, and he recommended that if she must wash that hand, that she do so with care and only around the margins of the kiss. She wrote, I was a little angry and peeved. Martha and Hitler never repeated their encounter, nor had she seriously expected they would. Though, as would become clear some years later, Martha did enter Hitler's mind on at least one more occasion. For her part, all she had wanted was to meet the man and satisfy her own curiosity. There were other men in her circle whom she found infinitely more compelling. One of these had come back into her life with an invitation for a most unusual date. By the end of October, Rudolf Diels had returned to Berlin and to his old post as chief of the Gestapo, paradoxically with even more power than before his exile to Czechoslovakia. Himmler had not only apologized for the raid on Diels's home, he had promised to make Diels a Standartenführer, or colonel, in the SS. Diels sent him a fawning thank you. "By promoting me to the Obersturmbannführer der SS, you have brought so much joy to me that it cannot be expressed in the short words of thanks." Safe, at least, for the time being, Diels invited Martha to attend an upcoming session of the Reichstag arson trial, which had been underway in the Supreme Court in Leipzig for nearly a month, but was about to reconvene in Berlin at the scene of the crime. The trial was supposed to have been a short one and to conclude with convictions, and ideally death sentences for all five defendants. But it was not proceeding as Hitler had hoped. Now a special witness was scheduled to appear. Chapter 21 The Trouble with George. Within Germany, a great flywheel had been set in motion that drove the country inexorably towards some dark place alien to Dodd's recollection of the old Germany he had known as a student. As the autumn advanced and color filled the Tiergarten, he came more and more to realize just how correct he had been back in Chicago in the spring when he had observed that his temperament was ill-suited to high diplomacy and playing the lyre on bended knee. He wanted to have an effect, to awaken Germany to the dangers of its current path, and to nudge Hitler's government onto a more humane and rational course. He was fast realizing, however, that he possessed little power to do so. Especially strange to him was the Nazi fixation on racial purity. A draft of a new penal code had begun to circulate that proposed to make it a key buttress of German law. The American vice consul in Leipzig, Henry Leverich, found the draft an extraordinary document and wrote an analysis. For the first time, therefore, in German legal history, the draft code contains definite suggestions for protection of the German race from what is considered the disintegration caused by an intermixture of Jewish and colored blood. If the code became law, and he had no doubt it would, then henceforth it shall be considered as a crime for a Gentile man or woman to marry a Jewish or colored man or woman. He noted also that the code made paramount the protection of the family, and thus outlawed abortion, with the exception that a court could authorize the procedure when the expected offspring was a mix of German and Jewish or colored blood. Vice Consul Leverich wrote, "Judging from newspaper comment, this portion of the draft will almost certainly be transacted into law." Another newly proposed law caught Dodd's particular attention, a law to permit killing incurables, as he described it in a memorandum to the State Department dated October 26, 1933. Seriously ill patients could ask to be euthanized, but if unable to make the request, their families could do so for them. This proposal, together with legislation already enacted governing the sterilization of persons affected by hereditary imbecility and other similar defects, is in line with Hitler's aim to raise the physical standard of the German people, Dodd wrote. According to Nazi philosophy, only Germans who are physically fit belong in the Third Reich, and they are the ones who are expected to raise large families. Attacks against Americans continue, despite Dodd's protests, and the prosecution of past cases seemed languid at best. On November 8th, Dodd received notice from the German Foreign Office that no arrest would be made in the assault on H.V. Kaltenborn's son, because the senior Kaltenborn could remember neither the name nor the number of the party identification card of the culprit, and as no other clues which might be useful in the investigation could be found. Perhaps because of his mounting sense of futility, Dodd shifted his focus from the realm of international affairs to the state of affairs within his own embassy. Dodd found himself, his frugal Jeffersonian self, drawn more and more to concentrate on the failings of his staff and the extravagance of embassy business. He intensified his campaign against the cost of telegrams and the length and redundancy of dispatches, all of which he believed to be consequences of having so many rich men in the department. Wealthy staff people want to have cocktail parties in the afternoon, card parties in the evening, and get up next day at 10 o'clock, he wrote to Secretary Hull. That tends to reduce effective study and work, and also to cause men to be indifferent to the cost of their reports and telegrams. Telegrams should be cut in half, he wrote. Long habit here resists my efforts to shorten telegrams to the point where men have fits when I erase large parts. I shall have to write them myself. What Dodd had failed as yet to fully appreciate was that in complaining about the wealth, dress, and work habits of embassy officers, he was in fact attacking Under Secretary Phillips, Western European Affairs Chief Moffat, and their colleagues, the very men who sustained and endorsed the Foreign Service culture, the Pretty Good Club, that Dodd found so distressing. They saw his complaints about costs as offensive, tedious, and confounding, especially given the nature of his posting. Were there not matters of greater importance that demanded his attention? Phillips in particular took umbrage and commissioned a study by the State Department's Communications Division to compare the volume of cables from Berlin with that of other embassies. The chief of the division, one D.A. Salmon, found that Berlin had sent 3 fewer telegrams than Mexico City and only 4 more messages than the tiny legation at Panama. Salmon wrote, "It would seem that in view of the acute situation existing in Germany, the telegraphing from the American Embassy at Berlin had been very light since Ambassador Dodd assumed charge." Phillips sent the report to Dodd with a 3-sentence cover letter in which, with an aristocratic sniff, he cited Dodd's recent mention of the extravagance in the telegraphic business in the embassy at Berlin. Phillips wrote, "Thinking it would be of interest to you, I enclose a copy of it herewith." Dodd replied, "Do not think that Mr. Salmon's comparison of my work with that of my friend Mr. Daniels in Mexico in any sense affects me. Mr. Daniels and I have been friends since I was 18 years old, but I know that he does not know how to condense reports." Dodd believed that one artifact of past excess, another curious hangover, he told Phillips, was that his embassy had too many personnel, in particular too many who were Jewish. "We have 6 or 8 members of the chosen race here who serve in most useful but conspicuous positions," he wrote. Several were his best workers, he acknowledged, but he feared that their presence on his staff impaired the embassy's relationship with Hitler's government and thus impeded the day-to-day operation of the embassy. "I would not for a moment consider transfer. However, the number is too great, and one of them," he meant Julia Swope Lewin, the embassy receptionist, "is so ardent and in evidence every day that I hear echoes from semi-official circles." He also cited the example of the embassy's bookkeeper, who, while very competent, was also one of the chosen people, and that puts him at some disadvantage with the banks here. In this respect, oddly enough, Dodd also had concerns about George Messersmith. "His office is important, and he is very able," Dodd wrote to Hull, "but German officials have said to one of the staff here, he is also a Hebrew. I am no race antagonist, but we have a large number here, and it affects the service and adds to my load." For the moment at least, Dodd seemed unaware that Messersmith was not, in fact, Jewish. He had fallen apparently for a rumor launched by Putzi Hanfstengel after Messersmith had publicly chastised him during an embassy function for making an unwelcome advance on a female guest. Dodd's assumption would have outraged Messerschmitt, who found it hard enough to listen to the speculation of Nazi officials as to who was or was not Jewish. On Friday, October 27th, Messerschmitt held a lunch at his house at which he introduced Dodd to a number of especially rabid Nazis, to help Dodd gain a sense of the truth.